This is the Microsoft Cloud Show, episode 169. Today, CJ and I are going to talk about some Azure news and Office 365 news, recorded live November the 29th, 2016. The Microsoft Cloud Show is sponsored by ShareGate. ShareGate makes it easier for organizations to adopt and use the latest Microsoft productivity tools, helping millions of users be happier and more productive at work. ShareGate is trusted by over 10,000 IT admins from over 110 countries to manage, migrate, and secure their SharePoint and Office 365 environments. ShareGate is recognized as the must-have tool for day-to-day administration of on-premises, cloud, and hybrid environments. Interested in learning more? Check them out on ShareGate.com to learn how ShareGate can make you more productive.
Hola, CJ.
What's up, amigo?
Good morning.
I'm practicing, you're getting me practicing Spanish for my Mexico trip coming up?
You know, you want to rub it in? Just rub it in a little bit?
Yeah, I'll be thinking of you while I roll over on my lounger from poolside.
Lovely. Well,
hey man, up here in Washington State, we need to get out every now and again when it starts getting glum and go get some vitamin D in other places. Not like you down there in Florida land where you've basically got sun all year round.
I would love to say that we have sun all year round, but we got it now, which is great for solar. So I love it.
Nice.
How you doing, man?
Pretty good. Pretty good. How's Thanksgiving for you?
Thanksgiving was good. We were supposed to have, I think, 18 or 19 people in my house. And the day before, my brother calls up and says, so he's got four girls, three are teenagers. The other one's a 2 or 3 year old. And he said, so the day before yesterday, the kids all came home from school and they had lice and they gave it to their younger sister. So we might, wondering what you think about that. And my wife kind of came back and she was like going, oh, I'm so sorry, we're going to miss you.
That's really funny. Yeah, parents' worst nightmare. Yeah.
So we went from having 18 or 19 at my house to just 12 or 13, which is still a lot of people, but it was much more manageable. And we had a boatload of leftovers. So.
Yeah, gotcha. Nice. We had we had a bunch of, we call it the orphans Thanksgiving, right? Because it's all of the expats or foreigners that don't have family in the States that we all get together and hang out. So it was pretty fun. We had a bunch of people come over.
Gotcha.
Well, that's nice.
That's cool. Yeah, I saw the pictures. It's looked like you had a good group and nice old time.
Yeah, it was really fun. Really fun.
Any political post-election battles?
Not really battles, no. We're pretty much all of a similar mind. So up here in liberal lefty land.
Yeah, we had thankfully no one brought it up at all until I think my brother-in-law and I sat up late watching the Pittsburgh-Indianapolis game on Thanksgiving night, and we're definitely of two different mindsets. I shouldn't say two different mindsets. We're probably of the same.
Some opposing views.
Yeah, we definitely voted for different people, but I think it was much more of a whole like, oh man, we're screwed. These are some crappy options that we had.
Yeah, gotcha. I got to say, like, we don't want to go too political on the podcast, obviously, but I really feel for people this Thanksgiving because it seems, I don't know about previous elections, but it seems like there's more conflict than ever. And we have a bunch of friends here that were sort of dreading going back to their families because of conversations and arguments and all that sort of stuff. So that would kind of
Yeah, I mean, I expected some stuff to kind of come up, but thankfully no one really brought it up, which is good. But it's,
no fist fights, that's the main thing.
No. No fist fights and no lice, so it was a good day.
You're definitely winning.
Yeah.
What do we got on? So what do we got on the cards this week?
So this week we're going to do another news show. We went boatload crazy with the a bunch of interviews for a while. So we got another news show back to back. Next week, I think we're going to have an interview, but it's more that I guess you're going to kind of interview me about my recent mind meld of ExpressRoute for Azure and Office 365, where I learned a ton. So we'll share a little bit of ExpressRoute in the next episode. But in this episode, we've got a handful of news that's come out around Office 365 and Azure. So we'll focus on that for this one today. Sound good?
Yeah, that sounds really good.
Yeah. What you been up to other than Thanksgiving? Anything else before we dive into the news?
Hanging a new TV on the wall, doing a bunch of home DIY, that sort of stuff. Mm. Pretty straight. Yeah. I feel very accomplished as a man right now. You know, like, you know when you do like home DIY stuff. I don't know. The dudes who are listening to this will probably understand. Like, men get great satisfaction from doing things like, and accomplishing like a task. Like, yeah. We're very task-oriented, job-driven sort of humans, generally speaking, of course. Very, very...
With our hands.
And I'm sure there are lots of women who are in exactly the similar boat. I just can't talk for them, so... I feel I get great satisfaction from having done a task, especially home DIY, like knocking holes in things and making it look good afterwards, which is sometimes not always the case. Yeah. So yeah, I hung a new 4K TV up on the wall off on a bracket, and you know, one of those articulating arm thingies,
yeah,
and ran a bunch of cabling through the walls and all that sort of stuff, and felt good. I've actually been watching. On this one thing, watching The Grand Tour, which is the new, effectively the new Top Gear, right? Let's be frank.
Yeah.
With James May, Richard Hammond, and Jeremy Clarkson. And they're on Amazon Prime Video. They actually let you stream it in, they call it Ultra HD, but it's 4K.
Let's market it up a bit.
Yeah, exactly. Make it sound a bit fancier. And in HDR, which I think is, you know how you could take photos on your iPhone with HDR where it's sort of two photos, one's slightly different exposure and they sandwich them together?
Mm-hmm.
They kind of do that for some shows now as well. Anyway, so I'm watching The Grand Tour on episode 1 and 2 on this 4K TV that does HDR, and it's glorious, man.
Mm.
It's the future of streaming for sure.
Oh, so was the picture you put up... The picture you share with me, that wasn't from an Xbox. That was from the show.
That was from the show. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah, you said 4K, yeah. And then I was like, wait, did you get one of those new Xboxes? And
no, sorry. That was off the Grand Tour. Yeah.
So I have a question about the Grand Tour. Is it family friendly, like language-wise?
Mostly. It depends where you draw the line.
I guess F word, S word, they're okay periodically. C word... Over the line.
Oh, yeah. No, not, definitely none of those.
Oh, okay, cool.
But, you know, James May's, you know, known for saying, oh, c-.
Yeah.
So
that's a British term. That's an expression.
Exactly, yeah. That's, yeah, that's like me saying, b-. I mean, that's not a nice word either when you think about it. But in New Zealand, it's like, oh, something went wrong.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, that's cool. I wanted to sit down and watch it with my son, but I didn't know if I was going to have to.
Yeah, it's not, it's definitely not R-rated, that's for sure.
Cool. Yeah, I've been... knees deep, eyes deep, whatever you want to call it, digging into Angular 2 and the SharePoint framework both at the same time. So next week, by the time this show comes out, I'm going to be at the SP Live 360 conference with a bunch of friends from down in Orlando, Florida. I'm doing a half-day workshop on the SharePoint framework, and I'm doing a session on Angular 2 and using it to build Office add-ins.
Hmm.
And I've done it before. I did it with the pre-release of Angular, and I was just updating some stuff and trying to change a couple things. But there's an issue that people are dealing with the SharePoint framework where you can do Angular 2, but you can only do it once on the page. If you have two web parts to use Angular 2, only the first one's going to work. And it's an order of operations in the way that Angular does things to optimize it, where it preloads everything and it has to know everything up front. So when you add a second web part to the page, it doesn't do the bootstrapping a second time.
Did nobody think about this?
Well, apparently not. I think that there's definitely some ways around it there. I've got a couple threads going, and thankfully I've got some good relationships with some of the senior people over on the Angular team. And so understanding the problem a bit more and working both with the people at Google and also working with the people, a couple really big people in the Angular 2 space, in the Angular space and in the community. And we're trying to figure out exactly, you know, how it is. It's an aspect of how Angular works and what they did to optimize it. And it really wasn't designed to be a build parts of a page. It's designed to kind of build an application. And you generally don't have lots of little pieces of an application on the page. Just SharePoint uses this concept of web parts, which can make it a little challenging. So
gotcha.
I want to see it work, and there's got to be a solution to it. This isn't like cross-domain scripting or something like that is a non-starter. So it's I think that there's definitely got to be a way to address it. But
gotcha.
Playing a bit with that and just jumping back into working on the SharePoint framework course that I'm going to have hopefully some fun news about in the next couple weeks. So
excellent. We will look forward to that.
Yeah. But hey, before we start going with the news here, why don't we take a quick break and have a word from one of our sponsors, and then we'll come back and do some news. The Microsoft Cloud Show is sponsored by Valid.nl. Valid's motto is stay ahead. Its mission is to enable its customers to excel in their business through the innovative use of IT. Valid is always on the lookout for new colleagues. Are you interested in all things happening in Azure, whether in infrastructure, SQL Server, Office 365, BI, SharePoint, or .NET? Look them up on Valid.nl. All right, let's come back from doing a word from our sponsor. And let's now talk a little bit about some news. So CJ, we've got a bunch of news here around Azure and Office 365. One of the things I know that we talked about last time, I'll take the first one real quick and then I want to pitch it over to you, but we're going to get about four or five things both in Azure and 365. So you guys are going to do a little ping pong. You're going to play the Office 365 guy. I'm going to play the Azure guy, but and we'll take one at a time. But the one that I wanted to kind of highlight here is we talked a little bit last week about price comparison and how someone had looked at the pricing information around AWS virtual machines and Google virtual machines. Yeah. And we said, hey, you know, Azure was excluded from this whole discussion. Wouldn't it be nice if someone sat down and actually did the whole add Azure to the mix of it? And guess what someone did?
Somebody did exactly that.
Exactly. Yesterday, on November the 22nd, Kim Weens from the RightScale site or RightScale blog sat down and actually explained how the pricing works. And she actually, or he, I can't tell, it's Kim. So looked at Google, Azure, and AWS virtual machines and showed the difference on pricing and how things work. Showed a couple of tables of different things and showed where some are better than others. And at least for me reading through this, there's no clear winner. It's just, it depends on what you're doing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It seems like, pardon me, it seems like if you're prepared to pay up front, then, you know, AWS and Azure might be a better choice. But if you're, you know, if you're not, then Google sounds like might be a better choice. If you want SSDs versus regular drives, there's options there as well. They sort of say in the conclusions at the bottom, they say, if you commonly need the performance requirements of a local SSD, you're going to pay a premium for it on Google Cloud, for example. So I guess it just depends on what you need at the time. Azure consistently matches or beats AWS on price for on-demand.
I thought that was interesting.
Versus reserved. I guess AWS do reserved instances. Azure does EAs for discounts, things like that. AWS is likely not going to be the cheapest in most of these scenarios, but is often in the middle. Interesting.
I found that the thing that's interesting about the approach that Azure and AWS take is that AWS takes the thing where you can say, we'll give you a discount if you do reserved instances, meaning you're going to pick a certain size VM and you're going to pay for that for the entire year. So we'll give you a break on it. You get that one instance. I personally don't like that model. I personally prefer the Azure model where with an EA, you can say, I'm going to spend this much. And so give me this kind of a break, assuming that I have this much of consumption, but it doesn't tie me to a specific VM.
Yeah. And that's how Azure EAs work, right? You say, I'm going to commit to, I don't know, $50,000 worth of Azure or something per year. And you have to agree for 3 years, but you can adjust the amounts that the EA is for each year. Mm-hmm. And then you can spend it on whatever you like. Mm-hmm. Right? You don't have to say it has to be compute. It could be storage. It could be big compute, small compute, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah. And so, and just to kind of also highlight a little bit about what we were talking about, how things are different between based on what you pick. Let me just give you two examples here. So first off, in Azure, we have one called the F2 instance, or let's pick one that's more common. How about the D2 V2 instance?
Oh, yeah, those are popular.
Yeah, with Azure, which is a two virtual CPUs with SSDs, with local SSDs. So AWS is right in the middle. This is all on-demand pricing as well. So this isn't like reserved or EAs or anything. With Azure, you're going to spend about 11.4 cents per hour, whereas with Google, you're going to spend 21.2 cents. So almost twice as much with Google than you would pay with Azure.
And I think that's the SSDs, right? They're saying that, you know, with SSDs, Google is more expensive. But if you get a standard, the same machine with no SSD, Google's down, drops to half that, 10 cents per hour.
Yeah, half that with, so 10 cents per hour. Azure stays the same at 11.4 cents and AWS gets to be the worst at 12 cents an hour. So it's this kind of a chart. This is important because you look at this, you can really do a good comparison. There is no clear winner. To me, there is no clear winner at all. It depends on what you're looking to do and how you're going to use it. And you have to look at the different options. So it's also, man, it is hard to go through and to do the equivalent VM on each of the different stacks too, I think.
Yeah, they don't always exactly match up, right?
No.
Hey, but one thing I thought was really cool about this article is it does a pretty good job of explaining how the different providers do their pricing and what's available. So if you're confused about cloud pricing, this would be a great article to read to get a good understanding overall, regardless of the numbers that they do, but just the explanation around it. of how each provider, you know, charges and how it all kind of works.
Yeah, I agree. So, hey, another bit of news here. Let's switch over to Office 365. So what do you have for us in the Office 365 world?
So Office is coming to some new markets. So if you happen to be in one of the following countries, you're in luck. Bhutan, Cambodia, Greenland, Guadeloupe, Laos, Maldives, Martinique, Mozambique, Myanmar, and the Vatican City.
Ooh, hey, there you go. The Pope can get,
you got mail. So now it's available in 150 markets in 44 different languages, which is pretty cool. So a little more global expansion. And actually, this article, we'll post it in the show notes. It's a very short blog. It's just a quick announcement. But they've actually got a world map, and they show the coverage of Office 365. And there's very little left, in fact. There's only a few countries left, or a few areas, I guess, left of coverage still needed. So I guess we will see in due course. Looks like Cuba might not be included still. Papua New Guinea, which is sad because I used to live there.
Oh, did you really?
Yeah. A few places, especially in Africa, there's a bunch of countries there that aren't covered yet. So anyway, Office 365 coming to 10 new markets.
Very cool.
Pretty exciting.
Very cool. I switched back over to the Azure side and talk a little bit about something called Azure Application Insights. So we neglected to mention this in our Connect news that we did in two of our recent shows, but Azure Apps Insights went generally available at the Connect conference, which kind of surprised me. I thought it was already GA, but at any rate, it went GA. Also, though, at the Connect conference, they announced two new preview features that they're putting in like the diagnostics area. These are interesting. I want to take a little more time to kind of play with these, but we'll have a link in the show notes of what these are. There's a quick 9-minute video that you can watch by a guy named Mr. Taylor. The two things that they have here is one is an application map. It's or improvements in application map that's going to allow you to see the health status of multiple components and pinpoint issues and find exceptions. And the other one is an application insights profile that's going to allow you to see detailed example traces of slow requests and drill into detailed analysis of code to see where you're spending the most time. Now, let me talk a little bit about each one of these. So what the application map, what the goal of this thing is to help you understand the overall health of your service and identify problems and get rich information and triage the root cause of any issues that you may have. So what they've done is the two big updates that they had for this, the two new improvements, are being able to see multiple components in the same application map, and then also have the ability to click on one of these components to bring up an error pane that's going to summarize the top errors. And then you'll be able to click on the errors to get even more detail. So in the images that they show on the blog post, they show a map of an application. So on the left-hand side, you've got a web app, and then you've got, that's the client application. So say that's going to be a single page app, or maybe it's going to be a mobile app or something like that. Mm. And then that's going to call into another website that may also call an API. Now, the website may reach back and call yet another API or call something else, like some sort of statistics monitor or something. And what's cool in the graph is it shows all these different components, and it shows where these components are in the tree of your application. And it shows either a green little check mark saying that there are no errors there, also showing like the number of page views that have gone on, what the average response time is. But then it also shows where there is a problem. It shows a red bang on there and shows, like in this case here, it shows 21.7% failures. I can drill into that, see what it's calling, and see the details of where the failures are actually coming from. So in this case here, it's showing us it's coming from a specific node process. So by drilling in, they're able to see things like the outgoing database calls made from a .NET API and see that there's a certain number of exceptions that are being thrown by a specific method on the API when they do an HTTP post to it. So it's pretty cool being able to, you know, drill in and see this. I've seen other tools for, I think there's one called Trace by the Rising Stack, or not by Rising. Is it Rising Stack?
No, it's
I just forgot.
Gosh, I've just forgotten now.
Yeah, it's a node. It's a popular node site that does they've got a really good node.
Yeah, Trace. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's one. But yeah, it's nice too, because this is all integrated into Azure. And I think that they're also kind of going a little bit to this debugging thing that Google has for Google developers. Hmm. The other thing that they added here was the Application Insights Profiler. So when running an app in production, there can be a number of unexpected causes of slow requests. So in many cases, if you have some of the requests which are fast, most of the time, but they can sometimes experience slowdown. So what this thing does is that it allows you to periodically enable profiling on your production service and collect detailed examples of perf traces for your app when something interesting happens, which is what that's going to allow you to do is to have examples of interesting issues with detailed code level breakdown and of request execution time profiles for a range of issues that you'll have the details for to pinpoint where the time is spent. So it's cool here because you can, it's the example that they show, we can see a couple charts going on where the server response time, and then we see server requests going, but we can see based on a dependent service where the errors are happening, where the slowdown's happening, and allows you to really quickly, you know, drill into it and see things like, you know, what's the 99th percentile? What's the 95th to the 99th percentile? What's the 75th to the 95th percentile? And you can see where these issues are happening, how common they are, if it's something you need to address, how you can drill into it. So
yeah, and get some more visibility.
Exactly, yeah. So it's two cool things that are there. By default, they're not available in Application Insights today. You have to enable the profiler on your account to be able to use it. But all the information is going to be in the blog post that we'll link to in the show notes here.
Cool. Yeah, that seems to be come quite a long way, App Insights. It's nice to see more capabilities. Hey, I've got one here on a new app coming in Office 365 called the Outlook Customer Manager, which is for small businesses. And it's basically a very lightweight CRM tool. Do you remember in Office, there used to be that thing called Contact Manager bundled with various editions of Office.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. So it turns out that's still incredibly widely used and is one of the main reasons why small businesses are not upgrading to new versions of Office, because Contact Manager, lack of support. It looks like the Office 365 team have come up with this new thing called Customer Manager, Outlook Customer Manager, to try and replace that by the looks of it and get people on newer versions of Office if you read between the lines. So the idea is that it doesn't take over from things like Dynamics 365, but sort of lets you start small and then grow into something like that. And the reason I say that is it's currently only available in the business premium SKUs, not in enterprise SKUs. And I suspect that's because they want you to go buy Dynamics instead. But they say they might be bringing it to E5 and E3 SKUs a little later on. But it's basically a set of add-ins to Outlook that let you keep track of all the conversations and things with customers and all those customer interactions, you know, without necessarily having to buy a full-fledged, you know, like Salesforce or Dynamics or something like that for CRM. Mm. So, you know, we saw the Bookings app, which was for managing, you know, bookings and calendar, like if you are, you know, a lawnmower or a hair salon or something like that. This kind of feels like another arrow in that quiver of small business-focused applications from 365.
Yeah, cool.
It should help people run their business a little, you know, lightweight businesses. Businesses with lightweight needs for this kind of thing.
Yeah, lightweight CRM.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Mm. So yeah, more stuff in Office for SMBs.
Cool. I'm going to switch back to the Azure side, and I got a really quick one here. This one was, I'm really glad this one came out when it did and not like a month or two prior to this. This would have been like a nice little gut shot. But title of blog post, Announcing Auto Shutdown for Virtual Machines Using Azure Resource Manager. And if anybody knows what you and I started doing and then what I was focused on earlier this year before I decided to put it on the shelf, I'm glad I wasn't going up against this. We knew it was going to be, I kind of expected that this would happen one day. But yeah, they've got a pretty cool feature on this. So basically what it is that in Azure Dev Test Labs, you have an ability in your self-service sandbox environment to be able to set up a time to when you want your virtual machines in the dev test environment to automatically shut down. And what Azure saw is that the most popular policy that was used was the auto shutdown policy. It was the number one policy that was used by customers. What customers really wanted to do is have it to be able to centrally not only add this to all of their normal VMs, not just the dev test VMs, but they also wanted to centrally manage this. So what it's pretty simple. What Azure has done is when you go into your VM blade and your Azure portal, so when you go in to find one of your virtual machines, there's now an option under the scheduling section or schedules section on the property pane where you can pick auto shutdown. You can turn it on, set the time, what time zone you want it shut down. And then you can say, send me a notification 15 minutes before shutdown. And if you enable that, you can set up a webhook. So say you're in Slack, you can go through and set up a webhook to sit there and post it. to something, maybe some Azure, send the message over to Slack. That's the one they have in the screenshot, but maybe you want to send it over to an Azure function that then does some sort of a analytics or checks something to see if a certain process is done and maybe reaches back in through the REST API to disable that from happening, or maybe schedule a shutdown to be an hour later or something. So I look at this and I'm like, you know, hey, I'm thinking about doing all my video rendering and stuff with Azure VMs, with the GPU VMs, and say, you know, start the rendering and set the shutdown to say 4 p.m. And when it reaches out, check to see if all the expected number of files are in a certain storage blob. And if they are, hey, great. If not, snooze it for 2 hours and let the thing keep running. But only want the VM up and running when I need it.
Yeah, nice. Nice. Yeah, it's taken quite a long time to get this sort of functionality. And like you said, we were about to go build a bunch of this stuff. Much more sophisticated than this, obviously, but this is a good start.
Yeah, it is. It's a good start, and at least it gives you a lot of the hooks. I mean, frankly, I would have, if I was still working on Curb, I probably would have set it up to say, go do this, go use this, instead of me having to go through and do it yourself.
Right. Yeah good, cool.
So,
hey, I've got one here about Microsoft buying LinkedIn. Apparently, it's causing all sorts of shenanigans in the EU around antitrust and Microsoft having too much access to this stuff or being in control of it. So Microsoft are offering the EU an Outlook deal to secure the LinkedIn acquisition. And basically what this means is, you know, there's a bunch of social connector stuff in Outlook and where people, profile information shows up in Outlook. Reading between the lines of this article, it looks like Microsoft is going to do a bunch more integration with LinkedIn data in Office. Ta-da, like big surprise, right? And they're basically saying, hey, EU, if you let us go ahead with this $26 billion acquisition of LinkedIn and sign off on it, we'll also let others, aka Salesforce, also surface their data in Outlook the same way we're planning on surfacing LinkedIn data as well. So, you know, there was the social connector for Outlook, and you could kind of set it up and you could connect it to Facebook and LinkedIn and your Windows Live contacts and stuff. I guess it's going to be a similar kind of thing. You know, when you hover somebody, you get a contact card. My bet is there's going to be LinkedIn data that pops up in those profile cards at some point. And they're probably going to offer the same access to third parties to be able to extend that functionality and add their own data in to Outlook as well.
Mm, that's the right thing to do.
Yeah, I think so. It makes sense, right? Because LinkedIn might be big in one place, but in China it might not be, or I actually have no idea if it is. But it also means that developers have access to go build additional data sources for those sorts of things into Outlook as well. And I guess it builds on the, you know, you've got add-ins for Outlook right now where you can put a contact, sort of a pane down the right-hand side or the left-hand side or what have you, in things like email or in the main view of Outlook and all that. You know, they're backed by web applications. Same sort of deal, I imagine, with the contact cards and stuff that are coming. So we will see, but I just thought it was kind of interesting that it's obviously causing some shenanigans in the EU, this deal, and they're having to start thinking of things to give in order to get this to pass.
Yeah, it makes sense. Maybe it makes sense they're adding that stuff.
Yeah, and I bet Salesforce are probably a bit pissy behind the scenes and pulling some strings to make it painful.
Oh, man, after the comments that Mark Benioff had, in the last few weeks about the honeymoon side and from last year, it was... He is completely ripped off the scab. Yeah.
So a loser?
Yeah. Just a bit.
Pretty much.
Cool. Hey, we got some more news, but before we dive into the additional news, let's take a quick break here and let's have another word from one of our sponsors. The Microsoft Cloud Show is sponsored by Rencore. Rencore is a market leader in the code analysis space. Founded and driven by high-profile international SharePoint and Office 365 experts, their main goal is to help any organization using Microsoft's enterprise productivity environments to work more efficiently by providing software that optimizes and secures their collaboration solutions. Rencore's most recognized product, the SharePoint Code Analysis Framework, SPCAF, is the de facto standard tool for verifying the quality, compliance, and governance of SharePoint and Office 365 customizations. If your company is using SharePoint or Office 365 and you're struggling to get your Office 365 and SharePoint under control, check them out at spcaf.com to learn all the ways that SPCAF can help you. All right, so let's dive back in. I've got one or two more Azure bits of news here. First one is around new Azure VM sizes. So Microsoft has introduced the AV2 series. They got a few new sizes that they've added to this. Now, the difference between V1 and V2 comes down to really the amount of memory that you're going to get, but also the size of the temp disk that you get. One example here, it goes from A1 all the way up to A8. If you look at the different options here, there's like an A. It's weird here how you say this. So you have like a standard A2 V2, and then now you also have a standard A2M V2. A little confusing, right?
Yeah, so, a little.
Basically, the way it breaks down is that when you look at the standard VMs versus the V2 VMs for the A series, I'm just going to take one for an example here. The A4, the standard one, they both have the same number of virtual CPUs. They both have 8 cores. The amount of RAM, though, is a little bit different. From the standard, the old one, it was 14 gigs. For the new V2 size, it's 16 gigs. The big difference here is in the size of the disk. So before, you got a 605 gigabyte disk, but it was a spindle. It was a hard disk.
Mm.
Now, you get an 80 gig SSD.
Gotcha.
Right? So that's now considered, that's from the A4 over to an A8, right? So A4 standard to an A8 V2. Anyway, this stuff gets confusing really quick here. There's a couple new options. My point is, we're going to have a link in the show notes where you can go look at a couple different tables and see the options that are available to you. But man, they're getting, I think that this announcement, hey, it's great, more options, but the naming now is pretty damn confusing, especially with the A series, because now you have the A series, you have AV2, and then you have A number M underscore V2. And it's like,
yeah.
So,
it's kind of hard to figure out.
Yeah, it's confusing. But anyway, there you go.
Something slightly more simple. Build an app, win some money. So Office have launched again, I think they did this last year as well, launched a thing called Hack Productivity. So put skills and insight you learned at Build, Ignite, and the Tech Summit this year to win some great prizes and recognition. $50,000, over $50,000 in prizes, including cash, tickets, and travel to Build 2017 and meetings with Microsoft Ventures. So if you've got a good idea, you can go and enter Hack Productivity, and there's various different challenges and different areas you can focus on and things like that, focused around Office 365, the Graph, and SharePoint to go build interesting new things, and you could win some money. And the submissions start now and are open through the end of January. So it's run via devpost.com, who sort of run hackathons and so forth. So you can go into that, and if you've got a great idea, go win some cash or win a trip to Build, by the sounds of it.
I got an idea that I'd love to sit down and do. I wish somebody would go do, because I don't have the time to do it. You know, we always complain about the fact that social media and messaging and threads and stuff is all fractured at Office 365.
Yeah.
So are tasks. So I've got, I would love to have something that synchronizes Planner between Wunderlist, or at least have Wunderlist have like the visual indicator with Planner, because now I decided to take a bunch of stuff I'm doing with Voitanos and use Office 365 groups and the Teams app to manage it, both myself and with the couple of people that are helping me with Voitanos that I've hired. But I'm used to using Wunderlist for everything, but then there's no Planner app for iOS. So it's kind of hard to see when the due dates are, when things are supposed to. I live by Wunderlist. And so it'd be nice to be able to have that stuff in Wunderlist, but have the nice Kanban style that Planner gives you.
Yeah, gotcha.
It's annoying.
I built an app that does that for Outlook. So when you flag something in Outlook, it creates a task in Wunderlist.
Mm.
And for the same reason, right? Because I want to flag email and stuff in my inbox.
Yep.
There is a Wunderlist add-in for Outlook that just lets you be looking at it, you know, looking at an email and click into Wunderlist and create a task, but it's like 2 or 3 clicks. And I just wanted flag it, create a task. And it uses the webhooks in Exchange Online to do it. It's pretty cool.
Mm. Very cool.
It sounds like you need a similar thing, except for Planner.
I remember when you you were working on this, but you didn't win any money, and that's why I said I don't have the time to do it and let somebody else do it. So
yeah, I didn't enter the hackathon with it, but maybe I should rewrite it and do it.
There you go.
Maybe I should do it in .NET. It was originally I wrote it in Node. Maybe I should write it in ASP.NET Core or something and do it in Docker somewhere. And yeah, anyway, we'll see.
Fun stuff. You got anything else?
I do. One last thing. There's an article that Julia White, who's CVP of Azure and Security at Microsoft, wrote called Top Cloud Myths of 2016. I haven't had a good chance to read all of it yet, but I just thought I'd bang out the myths. And she's written six of them here, and some of them are quite interesting. Myth number one, enterprises need only one cloud vendor. Myth number two, cloud security is riskier than on-premises. Myth number three, the main benefit of public cloud is efficiency more than innovation. Myth number four, hybrid cloud is the connection of public and private clouds. Myth number five, public cloud leads to vendor lock-in. And myth number six, open cloud development is a risk to innovation and intellectual property. So she's written quite a bit about each one of these, you know, sort of a decent paragraph or two on each one of these, and it's probably worth having a bit of a dive into, but some of them are kind of interesting. You know, obviously to, at the end of the day, make Azure look attractive and quell people's concerns or quash people's concerns about certain things, like the public cloud leads to vendor lock-in seems like a very interesting one, because that's typically what people have been worried about with Microsoft in the past. So yeah, I just thought it was an interesting article, and I hope they keep it up.
Yeah, that's cool. So I have one other one that I'll share around the Azure space. And this is something that was announced, I guess, in the last week. Specifically, it was announced from the Azure Media Services Group, but it's more around storage. This is a token authentication with Azure CDNs. So this is available for Azure CDNs from the Verizon Premium offering. So if you already are using Azure CDN and you're one of the existing Verizon Premium customers, you already get this. This is already enabled. If you're new to using Azure CDN with a Verizon from the Verizon Premium offering, you would get it as well.
Gotcha.
The idea here is that what you would end up doing with token validation or token authorization is it allows you to make it so that someone isn't hot linking your content from, say, a message board and using your assets without your permission.
I see.
That can impact your delivery costs, can impact some other stuff. What you can do here is that you could use this token when that someone is going to go request the request from your CDN, and the token's only available for a certain amount of time. So on your site, your site would be smart enough to go through and add this to the links when you're actually requesting it from the CDNs. The main benefits of this is it's very easy. It's easily scalable. There's no need to store user login information on the server. It's mobile ready. It provides security with each request must contain the token. And after the token expires, you need to log in again. And then it also prevents attacks such as the cross-site request forgery, or known as what's called session writing. So by enabling this feature on a CDN, each of the requests will be authenticated by the CDN Edge POPs before delivering the content, which prevents Azure CDN from serving assets to unauthorized users. And we'll have a link to that in the show notes where you can learn more.
Gotcha. So it's kind of like a pop a little window open, not a physical window, but a window in time where that link will work, and then sort of rotate the tokens as different people hit your site. Interesting.
Yeah, that's a nice option. Really nice option, especially if you're using it for like streaming video assets or downloads or something like that. You want people to be coming through your site to be able to get those things. Say, for example, if you, with the like Office 365 Pro Plus or some of those clients that you can install, Microsoft wants you to go through the Office 365 portal to get those. But I know as an OSX user, I can use Homebrew and install Pro Plus straight from Homebrew, which just hot links straight back to the content. This way, it would set it up to where I couldn't do that. I'd have to go through the website to get that content. So it'd be a nice little way for them to protect it if they wanted to do that.
Gotcha.
So, hey.
Cool. Lots of news.
Yeah, a lot of 365, a lot of Azure news. Do you get any picks this week?
Well, I thought I did, but then I'm, you know, I must be getting old because I'm not 100% sure we haven't already talked about this.
We haven't.
We haven't?
No, we haven't talked about the recent one, but yeah.
Okay, so the pick I've got then, and apologies if I have actually spoken about this on the show.
I love that we always do space stuff.
My memory's failing on me. Yeah, no joke, right? A measurement of impulsive thrust from a closed radio frequency cavity in vacuum.
Translate, please.
A new type of engine for stuff in space.
Without any fuel.
With no, well, fuel is energy, right?
No propellant.
No propellant. Yeah, that's probably a better way to put it. So basically, some dude, and I can't remember who figured this out, posted this thing, what, like a year or two ago?
Yeah.
And everybody poo-pooed him that he was seeing thrust from basically just using electricity with this sort of conical cone-shaped thing made out of brass, I believe, and saying that it was producing thrust. Not much, but some thrust. And everybody was like, this is like the perpetual motion machine type thing, right? Or fission or cold fusion, right? So everybody sort of ummed and ahed about it and poo-pooed it. But it turns out a bunch of people went and did some more research on this. And in the end, NASA has produced or written, or a bunch of people from NASA, among other people as well, went and did a bunch of proper scientifically tested things on this and then published a paper. And it's been a peer-reviewed paper that's now been published about it. And they've done this in a vacuum chamber and have shown small amounts of thrust from this thing. And nobody really still knows why.
I was going to see if you were going to say that. This is the funniest part about it.
Yeah. So they've reproduced it. They've done another set of tests. And they've said that, you know, there's some assumptions in here, right? And so that some other people can, and there's some things they could have done better in the tests or differently in the tests. And so they've challenged people to go do those as well. But from their findings, they've found that this thing produces thrust. And basically quite a lot more than things like Hall thrusters or light sails and other kinds of, I guess, non-propellant-based things. But enough for, you know, applications and things like satellites or in spacecraft that are going to other planets or different areas way far out, right? You don't need a lot of thrust. You just need a little bit of thrust for a long time. And you can actually get going quite quick. Anyway, so they've published this paper and it's full of acronyms and numbers and equations I don't understand. But the conclusion's kind of interesting.
I need to go back and find the other article. There's an article on The Verge that it was freaking hilarious because if I may paraphrase, I'm going to get this a little wrong here, but they basically said, hey, look, NASA came up with this whole idea of this EM drive. Again, like you said, it's a tiny amount of thrust, but in space, in a vacuum of space where there's no friction, when you have this drive going over a constant amount of time, it continuously adds the thrust or it adds speed. And so you turn it on for a while, and while you're going to start going really slow, you're never going to slow down. You're just going to keep speeding up. So ultimately, you could get going really, really fast.
Yeah.
So, and then other people went through and they validated it, like you said. The problem is, though, is that people still say, we don't understand why this is happening. We can see, we've proven that it's happening. There was this article on The Verge. I got to go find it. The title graphic for the article is absolutely hilarious. It's a picture of a unicorn. So the way that this thing works is with microwaves.
Yeah.
And the thrust comes out of using the microwave. So it comes out of the cone, but it's all generated using microwaves. It's a picture of a unicorn flying through space with microwaves and a rainbow coming out of its rear end. And he's like, the guy's like, okay, we get that it works, but no one understands why in the hell it works or can explain why in the hell it works. So we still think it's complete crap, but how in the hell is this even happening? That kind of stuff is really interesting.
Somebody will figure it out eventually.
Oh,
maybe
eventually,
the physics don't exist for this yet, but, well, the physics exist, obviously.
Yeah.
But our ability to explain it using equations and so forth may not exist. Anyway, so they turned this thing on. It's at 1937 megahertz is the frequency that's used. They put it in forward and reverse, so it's got two gears. They tested it at 40, 60, and 80 watts of power. And it generated roughly a thrust-to-power ratio of 1.2 millinewtons per kilowatt. Not a lot of thrust, but like you say, in the vacuum of space, with not a lot of friction, after a wee while, you'll get up to a fair clip.
Yeah.
And the benefit here is you don't have to carry a whole bunch of big fuel tanks.
That's the part I was just going to say, is that that's what's so impressive, is that you can fly without having to get refueled. You can just you can go through space, you can travel through space without having to refuel.
So long as you've got a power source, right?
Yeah.
That could get pretty sketchy, right? You need sun, basically, or you need a light source with solar panels, generate some power.
If you're going with sun, if you want to go the other way, you can use like nuclear or something like that, or like a fusion drive or an ion drive.
Yeah, true. I guess you could put like a radioactive power source on board that lasts bajillions of years.
There you go.
A long time. Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. Anyway, pretty cool. Nobody understands it, but produces thrust and we'll probably be able to get to other galaxies with it.
You know, it's funny how we don't even talk about our picks until the end of the show, and come to find out that we both, I know shockingly to our listeners, we both went with space themes.
Nice.
I picked up the, I started watching the series on National Geographic, Countdown to Mars. Have you seen this?
No, I haven't.
It's cool. So you can stream it straight from their site, or I think I had to get an app on my iPad, and then I just did the Chromecast up to the TV.
Cool.
I think they're on episode 3 now. If you read the book The Martian or saw the movie The Martian, it's very similar. And actually, Andy Weir, the author of The Martian, is involved in this. What they've done is they take the idea of, you know, hey, we have a mission to Mars. We're going to Mars. I think the mission is actually phrased around, this is the first mission to Mars. Mm. And they land, and then they start, you know, somebody got in the first episode, some stuff happened. I'm not going to spoil anything. I've only seen one of the episodes. There's a bunch of family who's in town, and they didn't care about it, so I got stuck. But anyway, it's cool because they positioned it both not only as like this is happening like in the late 2020s or 2030s as a real thing, but they also talk about present day, and they have interviews with Elon Musk. They have interviews with some people from NASA. It's really interesting, though, how they're kind of going through different individuals, talking to different individuals today and showing, you know, here's what the big deal about landing rockets was all about. And they show with SpaceX landing rockets, and how it was a huge accomplishment. And it's very educational. And also, it's also very entertaining as well. So I found the first episode absolutely awesome. Yeah, so I'm already hooked.
That's a great pick. I was definitely not aware of that, and I will absolutely watch it.
Yeah, get your to Mars.
No, definitely.
It's called Countdown to Mars.
No, that looks really cool. I will definitely tune in. Do you know how many episodes there are?
Right now, there are only 3 out there, but looking at the episode guide, they've got... So right now there are 6 episodes planned. So they've got, we've gone through, today's the 28th. They have 3 episodes that have come out so far, and they have 3 more to go through December 19th of 2016.
Awesome.
So
that's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's definitely interesting.
Great picks. Excellent. Cool.
But they do call it just season 1. So, hey, we'll see.
Yeah, it might be multiple seasons.
Yeah. Well, hey, dude, a lot of news, some picks here, and... another show in the books.
Yeah, thanks very much.
Absolutely. So hope to talk to everybody, hear from everybody. Let us know what you think about the show. Drop a line on Twitter. Leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. If you didn't like it, don't need to leave a review on iTunes. Like us on Facebook. Tell your friends. Hey, we'd love to, you know, it's, word of mouth is the best way to let us know. And if you haven't already, please go to the site if you're a listener and go up to the top and click on the listener survey. We'd love to find out more about our listeners. If you did do the survey, you should have something in your email from a couple weeks ago. If not, let us know and we'll send it to you. But there's a way, we've added some additional fields to the survey, and I can send you a link to where it only have you answer the survey for the new questions, so you can just merge them in with the old questions. So gotcha. If you did the survey before, contact us. We'll send you a new link. But if you haven't done the survey before at all, we'd really appreciate if you ran over and filled it out for us.
Nice.
Awesome. Hey, CJ, I will talk to you again soon.
All righty. Have a good one.
You too, bud. Did you like this episode? Send us a tweet about it and drop us a 5-star review in iTunes. Word of mouth recommendations are the most effective ways for us to grow the show. Really appreciate it. If you have a question for us, go to microsoftcloudshow.com/questions, where you can submit it as text. We'll record it as a WAV or an MP3 and provide a link so that we can play your question on the show. Our theme music is an excerpt from Evaporated Air by Monk Turner, used under Creative Commons. You can subscribe to us on iTunes and the Google Play Store by searching for Microsoft Cloud Show or via RSS at microsoftcloudshow.com, where you'll also find show notes of each episode. You can also find us on Facebook, searching for Microsoft Cloud Show, or on Twitter at MS Cloud Show. And finally, sign up to our mailing list by heading to our website and entering your email to interact with us, participate in upcoming interviews, and other cool stuff. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.